This is Wisconsin Public Radio. Welcome to Spectrum West. It's about who we are, what we do for each other, and what matters in Wisconsin, most specifically in Western Wisconsin. I'm Al Ross, and this week, if you haven't already, you'll learn about the subnivium, a seasonal phenomenon that we should care about. We'll have two Wisconsin scientists who do on the show today. Jim Oliver's here with what's on stage around the region, and he'll preview the newest production of the St. Croix Off-Broadway Dinner Theater. The Big Banbury Art Crawl is Friday and Saturday in Eau Claire. We have details of this popular annual event. And a couple symphony orchestras are engaged in music and music-related endeavors. Kevin Peters is here from the Red Cedar Symphony with a look at things on their plate. And we'll get underway with news from the other, the Chippewa Valley Symphony Orchestra, which Saturday afternoon presents a popular annual concert that focuses on future generations of musicians. And to get a preview, what better way than to get it through an introduction to the symphony's new executive director, Sarah Koken. You have a colorful guest conductor, Randall Swigum, coming. From what I found out and read, he has a long history of working closely and effectively with young people. In the Madison area, he's a big guy in the Elgin Youth Symphony down in Illinois. Tell us a little bit about Randall.
Yes, Randy is a very energetic conductor. Most orchestra and band teachers are familiar with his work. This program is really about making the music more approachable to the kids that are going to be in our audience, something that's going to grab their attention, but something that's going to help them understand how music works, how the sounds are working together to make a piece of music.
Mm-hmm. Most of the time, a young person's not only introduction to music, but also their continued love of music has to do with a pretty strong personality that happened early in their lives. When you see somebody like him on the podium, you say, I want to hang out with those kind of people for a long time.
Absolutely. And I think that's something that our symphony players tried to do too when they went into our third grade music classrooms here in the past couple weeks. Try and make music exciting and something that draws you in, a very magnetic thing that hopefully grows a music appreciation from a young age so that students can take that with them for the rest of their lives.
Congratulations on the appointment, Executive Director of the Chippewa Valley Symphony Orchestra. What leads you to this position?
It was something out of right field. Really, I was actually working at the University of Wisconsin-Eau Claire in a finance role for continuing education, and I saw this posting and I thought, hey, I love music. Things they were looking for in the position description spoke to me. It was something I felt I could do. I was ready to take a next step in my career, and I really have a passion for music and being able to make it accessible to everybody and not that it's stuffy. We want to make it accessible to everybody.
Have you hit the ground running?
I hope I'm at least hitting the ground walking briskly. Things are going well so far. As I mentioned, we have gotten a lot of musicians out to the schools this year. It's really great to hear that the students are excited to come to our concert on Saturday. And in March, we'll be showcasing elementary school art in the Janet Carson Art Gallery. And so we'll be having a small reception for those students, and they're invited to come to our March concert.
The concert on Saturday, it's called Beethoven Superhero, is for young people. It involves not only the symphony orchestra, but also the youth symphony orchestra and the Christo Orthodontics Young Artist Competition winner, who is Emily Hauer from Appleton. What does she do?
Emily Hauer is a violinist. Okay. She just turned 15, and she is absolutely amazing. Mm. I listened to her when she was performing her piece in mid-January during the competition. It just left the audience breathless. She had everything memorized, and the piece was very technically difficult. It was just amazing to see such a young, passionate person be able to just do that in front of everybody. I think I'm really just excited to have all of those kids in the audience to look at another young person on the stage who's a hard worker, who's passionate about music, and that she's doing her dream of playing music.
Concert begins 4:30 p.m. Saturday at the State Theater. What's the mechanics of the concert? Will the Youth Symphony be playing with the grown-up symphony? Are they going to play separately?
The Youth Symphony will play separately.
Okay.
For the first 45 minutes or so, the Chippewa Valley Symphony Orchestra will be performing. Randy will be up there too, talking to the kids in the audience about what's going on. There'll be a brief intermission, and then the Chippewa Valley Youth Symphony will play for about 15 minutes, and then Emily will wrap up our concert at the end, and she will be accompanied by the Chippewa Valley Symphony Orchestra.
Okay. Will Nobu have a presence at the concert?
Nobu has graciously offered to conduct the slideshow presentation from the light booth that goes along with Randy's conducting in the first half.
Okay.
And I'm sure Nobu will be on stage also to congratulate our winners.
I mean, what's a concert without him? You brought up ambassadors from the orchestra going to third grade classrooms. That's the time I started playing the violin, was in third grade. And third graders have a perk for Saturday's concert.
They do. Every third grade class that we visited in the Eau Claire area and in the Chippewa Falls School District area receives a golden ticket, which is good for two tickets, either a student youth ticket or an adult ticket, to come to our concert. So we're really hoping not only will they bring a parent or a guardian, but that they'll bring the rest of their family too, something that everybody can enjoy.
Let a little cat out of the bag in its 42nd season. Chippewa Valley Symphony in March will be going to Italy, figuratively. Give people a little hors d'oeuvre there, a little Italian food hors d'oeuvre. Sarah Kochan, thanks for being with us. Always nice to have a first-hand look at what's upcoming. Of course, the website is cvsymphony.org. All the best in your new position, and keep us in the loop. We love the symphony and all that it means to our area.
Sounds good, Al. Thank you.
Your name can be on a percussion instrument. A comedy with music comes to Hudson. The Subnivium needs our help. All coming up on Spectrum West. Right now, it started as a small event in a big place, and it's grown into one of the gotta-go-there things to do. It's the Banbury Art Crawl, and it's here, Friday and Saturday, in two buildings of the factory-turned-functional space in Eau Claire. A couple organizing committee members and artisans, Bruce Warren, a photographer, and Dennis Kinzel, furniture maker, visited the studio and brought details, along with a bit of background, like Mr. Warren, who has spurned the digital age and continues to shoot on a very big and old camera.
I'm still using film and 4x5 view cameras. I don't do digital. Everything's done in my darkroom, still sloshing chemicals and all that good stuff, yep.
And your purpose is to what? Be original, genuine?
Too much of a learning curve, and I have too much money wrapped up in the analog end of it. So I really didn't want to go that route. It's all black and white, too.
It must be nice for guys like you to have witnessed how photography has gradually grown into an art form, because it wasn't always that way.
Right. A lot of people had a fight for that, and there's still a few people around who will tell you that it's not an art form, but pretty much we decided back in the 70s it was.
And Dennis, as an artiste, you do the physical furniture making, plus other things.
Yeah, I do. My main occupation over the last 30-plus years has been furniture making.
Okay.
Although I started out heading in a divinity role, I was in a master's of theology program. I had sort of put myself through college working for an antique restoration company and just got the bug taking things apart and putting them back together, and decided to follow Jesus a different way back then and became a carpenter of sort and apprenticed with a woodworking shop and kind of went from there. I started doing furniture designs and had some success with that.
And you know what? Just after meeting you, 10 minutes ago, I can tell one of your characteristics already, and that is you are patient. Because furniture makers have to be patient. I had a grandfather who was a furniture maker, and when my brother and I used to sit in his shop with him, he would plane and he'd go. And sanding was the same thing. You know, you could go a little faster, but that's the way you make furniture.
Yeah, or any type of art, I think. You get lost in the process itself. So the end result is obviously what you're going for, but it's also the whole process of getting to that and, you know, picking the woods, putting them together and, you know, making sure you've got the right scale and the right finishes. And for me, it's about, you know, getting all the steps right, going from A to Z and not missing anything so that you have a product you can be really proud of and the people that buy it.
As wonderful as it is to hear about your talent and commitment to the arts, we have business, and that is the 8th annual Banbury Art Crawl, and you guys are here because you are on the committee. You have over 100 artists and vendors, I see.
Yep. We have probably 27 residential people who have their shops or businesses in Banbury. And then there's like 75 guest artists coming in. And they will be both in Building 13 and in Building 10, which Building 10 is behind 13. Yeah, we're going to have all kinds of artisans of one sort or another, almost anyone you could think of. We're going to have musicians wandering around. We're going to have dancing. Yeah, it's just getting bigger and bigger every year.
I don't think Laurie Beasy had the notion that this was going to be as big as it turned out to be.
No, no. Initially, it was supposed to be biennial.
Let's talk about more of some of the particulars. Parking is kind of at a premium, but you guys have solved that problem because you have some shuttles going on, don't you?
Yeah, Volume 1 has a shuttle. You can park your car downtown, and then Volume 1 has a bus that'll be coming periodically to the venue. There's a big parking lot behind Building 10. There's a lot of parking out there, but if you don't want to do that, you can always take the shuttle.
I think last year was the first year that I really noticed how popular this was. It felt to me, and I think I made this comment to somebody, you can go from level to level to level to level to level. I felt like I was in a big anthill. There were people all over the place.
Yeah.
And it's fun.
There's about 5,000 people that come through in 2 days. So it's quite a large event, and it's a complete family-oriented event. So, you know, definitely bring kids. Building F13, that was the maintenance building for the old Uniroyal Tire Factory. So there's three levels there that people get to walk through, as well as Building 10, which is right behind Building 13. A lot to see, a lot going on there.
So the hours are when?
Friday, they're from 4 to 9, okay. And then on Saturday, 9 to 5.
A lot of people come after work on Friday. They're both really busy days. And remember, it is Valentine's Day, so this might be an opportunity for people to pick up something special for their sweetheart.
Yeah, you'll never know what you'll find. It's always a sort of a treasure hunt in a way.
And all that wonderful stuff makes a person thirsty and hungry, and there are amenities.
There actually will be, yeah, good food. Forage will be having food up there, and we'll also be serving in Building 10, as well as, I think there's actually beverages that you can get at Forage, as well as music going on.
You can get wine at Forage this year,
wine,
too.
Wine, yes.
All right. And these are big places, so maps are essential.
There will be maps available when you come in the door.
Yep, you'll get a package, and they'll show you both buildings and what's on what floor, and you can figure out a list of the artists and where they're located. So if you're somebody you really want to find, you can find them easily.
And if you want to prepare yourself, all of that information is on the website as well. I mean, there are maps of the building. And so, hey, way to go. Nice job being on the committee. Did you have to volunteer, or were you appointed?
I volunteered.
I also volunteered.
That puts you in a better light now.
But it's a great event, and it's just fun to be part of and feel the energy that is happening there. Wouldn't be possible without Jack Kaiser, Patty Sykin from Banbury Place opening that up. And then Volume 1 is a huge sponsor, too. So we need to shout out to those people. Yep.
Bruce Warren and Dennis Kinsel, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
Thank you, Al.
The Banbury Art Crawl. But, you know, don't take that literally. You don't want to be down there close to the floor. There's way too much to see. The website is banburyartcrawl.com. That's Banbury. Spectrum West on Wisconsin Public Radio. Support for WPR comes from Marquardt Toyota, committed to delivering an authentic and enjoyable automotive experience. Marquardt Toyota is located off Highway 53 between Eau Claire and Chippewa Falls, or at marquardttoyota.com. Support also comes from Neff's Piano, selling new and reconditioned pianos from a showroom on Water Street in Eau Claire, providing tuning, repair, and piano restoration in western Wisconsin since 1985. Neff'sPianos.com. Here's a Spectrum memo for you. There's a Writer's Read event to celebrate Valentine's Day. It's called What's Love Got to Do With It? And it's at the L.A. Phillips Memorial Public Library in Eau Claire. If you're listening on Thursday, it's tonight. If you're listening on Friday, you missed it, and they'll have more. It begins at 6 p.m. Bring your original prose or poetry with a love theme. Read aloud for up to 5 minutes, or just show up and listen. Info at ecpubliclibrary.info. Well, many things are dormant during the winter months, but not some of the theater companies and venues of western Wisconsin. Here again, Jim Oliver.
Thanks, Al.
The Chippewa Valley Theater Guild will present Moon Over Buffalo through Sunday and the following Thursday through Sunday at the Grand Theater in Eau Claire. A Tale of Two Cities, based on the novel by Charles Dickens, will be staged by the Barron Spotlighters Friday through Sunday and the following Friday through Sunday at the Barron Area Community Center. The St. Croix Off-Broadway Dinner Theater of Hudson will present special Valentine's Day weekend performances of Two Sugars, Room for Cream, Friday and Saturday. The Phipps Children's Theater will present Peter Pan Friday through Sunday at the Phipps Center for the Arts in Hudson. The show will continue weekends through February 26th. The Old Gem Theater of New Richmond will present A Little Red Riding Hood for student audiences weekdays through February 24th. And the Phipps Children's Theater will hold auditions for students in grades 7 to 9 for Rapunzel on Monday and Tuesday from 6 to 8 p.m. at the Phipps Center for the Arts in Hudson. For Spectrum West, I'm Jim Oliver.
Well, another of the premier musical aggregations living and breathing in western Wisconsin is the Red Cedar Symphony Orchestra, under the very capable guidance and baton of Mr. Kevin Peters. Their spring concert is still a couple months away, in early April, but they're busy as usual, and the door is always open to fellow musicians.
We're always looking for more musicians to join the orchestra, especially in our string section. And this particular concert, I think, is a great one for those who might be considering joining us to take that leap if they've been afraid of some of the repertoire in the past. This spring concert is all recognizable music. I really wanted to program in it a way that families and musicians will recognize it, the centerpiece of the concert being Beethoven 5. We're excited to welcome new people. We already have some new names. I know there's been some calls to musicians out in the newspapers, but wanted to make an extra plea. If there's people in the Northwest area that have been thinking about joining the orchestra, now is a great time to do it. We rehearse Sunday afternoons at Bethany Lutheran Church in Rice Lake, 6 rehearsals before our concert. You know, a great concert weekend, like you mentioned, coming up in April.
As you said, you always need string players. Are there openings in the other departments, woodwinds, brass, percussion?
We do have a need for some French horn players coming up in this spring concert. We're always looking for more bassoon players as well.
Is that because there are just less of the woodwinds, brass, and percussion? Obviously, percussion in a symphony.
Well, wind players and brass players in the orchestra, it's one per part, so there's no doubling. And then in the strings, a lot of times, you know, obviously there are multiples and doubling in larger sections. They don't project as well, and a lot of the orchestral writing calls for a big sound in the strings. You know, ideally you can have anywhere from 8 to 12 first violins and second violins and 10 or so violas, 8 cellos, 4 to 6 basses. Yeah. That's how the big orchestras get up to an 80-piece orchestra.
Yeah. Is there an optimum number of members in the orchestra that you like to maintain?
I don't have an optimum number. It always seems to be hard finding viola and cello players. The violins seem to come and go as people move in and out of the area, but viola, cello, bass always seem to be an area where we're scouring the forest, so to speak, for more and more players out there.
Speaking with Kevin Peters, musical director of the Red Cedar Symphony Orchestra. They have a lot of stuff coming up as their season gets underway. The Red Cedar now in its 34th year. That's impressive. Let's look even further down the road to the 2017-2018 season.
Well, that's going to be a surprise for now, Al, but we are going to be announcing the 17-18 season is going to be coming out in our spring newsletter, which will be in the mail within a couple of weeks here. So people will find out our 17-18 season. I can tell you it's going to feature a soloist of the orchestra as well as our biannual student concerto competition. So people can check out our website, redcedarsymphony.org. Our Facebook page, and if they want to get on the mailing list and receive our newsletters and concert announcements, you know, they can certainly do that from the website.
I was hoping for a little bit of a scoop there, but I guess I'm not going to get it.
Not yet.
So let's talk about something we can reveal. Let's talk about the spring concert. It will feature a very famous symphony.
The spring concert is going to feature Beethoven's Symphony No. 5 in its entirety.
Mm.
And I'm very excited. People recognize the first movement, and then they might recognize a little bit of the fourth movement. The entire symphony is just fantastic. What Beethoven did with a four-note motif is absolutely incredible throughout the entire symphony.
Uh-huh. Can you give us those four notes?
Yes, absolutely. Da, 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 da.
Yeah, and everybody will recognize that. And then you have shorter pieces. You've got Mozart. You have Bizet.
Yep, we've got the Allegro from the Eine Kleine Nacht music, again, is another one people recognize, just the first movement of that. And then we move into Elgar's Nimrod from his Enigma variations, which is a massive piece. We're just choosing the ninth variation out of there. And then moving into Bizet, who's probably most well-known for Carmen, his opera. We're not going to use Carmen. We're going to do one of his other pieces called L'Arcien Suite. If people sit back and they don't recognize the titles, they'll recognize the music.
Now, you also have something called a push for percussion, little alliteration there. What's going on?
This is a really exciting time for the Red Cedar Symphony. You know, we're celebrating our 34th anniversary, and it's really I view this as a period of growth for the orchestra. We've been growing in size for musicians, and we've been growing in size in our audience as well, and we've added a summer concert in the park. The 17-18 season is going to be adding a small chamber concert. So it's a really exciting time, and one of the things we've realized is that as we grow and move into new performance spaces, we're dealing with outdated or non-existent percussion equipment. So it's limiting some of what we can do or we have to borrow it. So we're starting a push for percussion, as we call it, and our goal is to, over time, purchase all of the major percussion equipment we would need. You know, xylophone, bells, snare drums, I mean, you name it, a lot of the stuff we don't own. So it's time, and we've established ourselves, and I know we're going to get the community support. Coming out in our newsletter will be information on that, and again, online, if people want to donate, they just simply need to make a note of percussion in the memo line, and we'll make sure that their donation goes towards that. It could be something as simple as a $65 donation, which buys us a set of wood blocks.
I would think it would be kind of neat to be the sponsor of a triangle.
You know what? The triangle is on our list. Symphony quality triangle, believe it or not, including the beaters that are needed to play it.
Yeah.
$100 even. Can I put you down for that one?
I'm going to look at the list. I might want to go bigger. You know,
you can donate the entire set of timpanis. You might be looking at somewhere around $10,000.
Yeah, as long as the plaque is big enough. So how about a vibra slap?
Those will borrow as needed.
I think a symphony without a vibra slap is like a day without sunshine.
I don't remember the last symphony composer to use vibra slap. I haven't found it in the Beethoven 5 score yet.
Well, but think about adding it. That would be unique.
It's a fun instrument, that's for sure.
As usual, the Red Cedar Symphony Orchestra is busy and getting busier as time goes on. Kevin Peters, thanks for being with us. We will do all we can to keep your news out there to all of the WPR listeners. And good luck in the push for percussion. I think that's going to be very successful, I predict.
I do too. Thanks a lot, Alan. We appreciate you and, of course, your listeners for their continued support.
The website is redcedarsymphony.org. Thanks for being with us on Spectrum West. Hope you're having a good time. We are. There's Broadway and there's Off-Broadway. Hudson, Wisconsin's considered the latter. Spectrum West special correspondent Jim Oliver takes us there to see what's up and what's on.
The St. Croix Off-Broadway Dinner Theater will stage a pre-Valentine's Day weekend special production of Two Sugars, Room for Cream. The show will play Friday and Saturday evenings and Saturday matinee at the theater in Hudson. Joining us by telephone to talk about this special two women's Valentine's Day show is Jim Zimmerman. Well, welcome back to Spectrum West.
Well, glad to be with you again.
I don't think you have very many opportunities to see a play that features two playwrights on stage. This is the first one I've ever heard of. I suspect it's been done a time or two. But anyway, tell us what the show is about.
Two Sugars, Room for Cream suggests coffee. And that is sort of the bond that ties the show together. These two women you speak of, Shannon Custer and the other playwright is Carolyn Poole, although Carolyn will not be performing in our version of the show. She's been replaced just for this production by Laura Adams. Basically, Shannon and Carolyn wrote this as a sort of a means of creating real, believable characters, women in their 30s, because they were kind of frustrated because they weren't finding any roles in the cities. Although these two people, Shannon and Carolyn, are the funniest, I am not prejudiced, are the funniest two actresses you will find in the cities with their background and the shows they've done. So they went together. They wrote a series of vignettes, all centering around coffee, because it seems like all the major events in life happen with or are followed by coffee. You know, mm-hmm. if you go to a funeral, well, everybody gets together after the funeral for coffee. Or you get together with somebody and want to share information, you're doing it over coffee. You're solving the world's problems over coffee. And so it sort of creates a leitmotif, if you will, for this series of scenes, sketches, most of which are very funny, by these two young ladies.
Mm-hmm. You know, one Minneapolis reviewer wrote something I found was, it's a two-person show that isn't constrained by the fact that it's a two-person show. The comedy comes from the humanity of the characters and the fact that we recognize ourselves or people we know in all of them. Now, I understand that they play a number of different characters.
That's correct. So there is no single sort of character that flows through it. There are various characters, all obviously in their age range and gender, going through the things that happen to them in life.
Now, there's music. Would you call it a musical comedy or a comedy with music?
Oh, it's a comedy with music. It's incidental type of music. They do sing very well, by the way. And so it just creates variety for the evening. If you are enjoying a scene, it's nice to break out into song every once in a while, and that's what they do.
The show got its start at the Minnesota Fringe Festival. How did it kind of develop from there?
Well, after the Fringe Festival, I think that was in 2008, 2009. It actually won some awards. I believe it won the 2013 Ivy Award. It was mounted in the cities at a variety of theaters. And so they've been writing it sort of ever since it was premiered at the Fringe Festival in 2008. And it was a shorter version then. They've now expanded it into a full-length play, and that's happened over the years as they've experimented with it in various venues. And their performance at St. Croix Off-Broadway Dinner Theater, it's just a continuation of that. They've rewritten some of it. There's some new scenes, new sketches. So even if you've seen it before, perhaps in the cities, you'll find some new stuff in there because they're continuing to tweak it, as most playwrights will tend to do. This is probably the last production of it that's going to be mounted before it'll actually be published and then released for others to do. Up to this point, it's just been Shannon and Carolyn doing it.
Now, getting back to the music for just a minute, is it basically recorded music, or do you have some kind of a backup group?
No, it is recorded tracks, mm-hmm. Obviously live vocals, but recorded tracks.
Mm-hmm. Well, what's coming up at the St. Croix Off-Broadway Dinner Theater?
Oh, well, even as we teched this show this past weekend, getting ready for its opening, at St. Croix Off-Broadway, we were also in rehearsal for our spring show. Since Two Sugars runs only one weekend, it's kind of our Valentine's Day gift to our audiences. We're also in rehearsal for The Marvelous Wonderettes, the musical by Roger Bean. And so that will run from mid-March, I believe it's March 10th, into May. It's a nice long run. And that is another musical. Basically, the story is about somewhat fictitious, four young ladies who are graduating from high school and performing as the Marvelous Wonderettes, a singing group, at their super senior prom during Act One. And so they host their prom, and we hear all these wonderful numbers from the late 1950s. And then Act Two comes along, and it's now 10 years later. They've graduated, and they're back as the Marvelous Wonderettes performing for their 10-year class reunion. And we find out all the things that did happen to them, who got married, who got divorced, who got pregnant, et cetera, and all the dreams that they had as graduating seniors now have had a chance to either succeed or fail.
Well, just to get into a little bit of the background of theater operation, how do you go about selecting plays for your seasons?
You know, it is a complex deal. There's a variety of things that go into it. At the heart of it, though, is we look at what we think our audiences will enjoy. Because the bottom line, we're there to entertain. Yeah, we may educate a bit from time to time, but we're really there to entertain. So we look for things that are fun, a lot of music quite often, comedies, that sort of thing. And then we look at what's popular out there. And we also look at our castability. You know, our cast of, you know, we have many folks that come back and work with us from show to show, but we also look for new folks. With Marvelous Wonderettes, for instance, it's a four-woman show, but they have to, I mean, they have to sing. I mean, these young ladies have to really be able to sing because it's close four-part harmony all the way through it, and they all have solos. So we didn't choose that show until we were sure we had a good cast, and we do. These four young ladies are marvelous. So all those things factor into selecting the season. It's funny you mention that because we're actually in the process right now of picking a season for our next year because Wonderettes closes our season, which ends in June. So we're looking for starting up again in the fall, and we're picking our season for that.
Mm-hmm. Now, you don't have a theater company per se. You kind of go out and beat the bushes for people you've known before and that sort of thing.
We cast on a show-by-show basis, although, as I said, a number of folks, about 80% of our cast are returning people. For Wonderettes, three of the four young ladies are actually from other shows. We've cast them before. One is brand new to us. So, yeah, about 75-80% of our cast is returning folks. But we don't have a core company of actors that we're committed to keeping busy for every show because we want to have the flexibility to pick shows based on our audiences, based on the entertainment value, and then fill with cast members as as we can find them.
Now, you have joined me in the ranks of the retired. So what are you doing with yourself these days?
Well, by retired, you mean I have left the University of Wisconsin River Falls as an academic. And yes, I have in the summer of 2015 pulled a pin on that. So it's been about a year and a half that I have been down to one full-time job, and that is working with the Dinner Theater. So that's kept me plenty busy. Beyond that, I'm also writing. I'm continuing to write, or rewrite, rather, the musical that I wrote and we mounted at the Dinner Theater. Also is mounted out in L.A., the musical based on the lives of the Righteous Brothers, currently titled That Love and Feelin'. So I'm rewriting that, and it will be actually workshopped in Iowa this summer with a couple of companies, one called Venue Works, which is based in Iowa, and the other one is Troop America out of the Twin Cities with Kurt Wallen. They've gone together and wanted to generate a tour, and so we're going to first workshop the script with some actors, make some tweaks on it, and then it'll go out on tour. So that's keeping me busy, and I'm also continuing to write. You know, there's more things in my head than I can ever get out of it, so there's another musical I'm looking at, doing the research on right now, based on the lives of Simon and Garfunkel. So there's plenty to do. You know, they say the thing about retirement is you don't want to get bored. Well, there's not a problem there.
Well, the thing I found with being retired is you do what you want to do, not necessarily what you have to do.
That is exactly right. That's well put.
Well, we've been talking to Jim Zimmerman of the St. Croix Off-Broadway Dinner Theater in Hudson. The theater will present the two-women show, Two Sugars, Room for Cream, Friday and Saturday evenings and Saturday afternoon. For ticket information, you can use your favorite internet search engine to find the St. Croix Off-Broadway Dinner Theater. Jim Zimmerman, you're always fun to talk to. Thanks so much for being with us again.
Well, thank you very much. It's a pleasure.
And thank you, Jim Oliver, very much. This is Spectrum West on Wisconsin Public Radio. And support for WPR comes from Chulson's Corner Motors of Cadott, offering Chrysler, Dodge, and Jeep vehicles with personalized service to meet customer needs. Chilton Corner. That's not Chilton. It's Chulson Corner Motors of Cadott.com. Let our family take care of your family. Hey, you know, if you don't know what the subnivium is, you will after today. And hopefully you'll also have an appreciation for the circumstance, the commitment, and the people. The title of an article that caught my eye, Beneath the Snowpack Lies a Secret Ecosystem, the subnivium. I think most of us who get around the winter landscape a bit more than just the path from the house to the garage are aware of life under the snow, but not to the extent that it's virtually there. An actual metropolis with a climate all its own.
As climate change happens, the Subnivian climate is also subject to those changes we're precipitating. Enter John Pauly and Ben Zuckerberg, both PhDs in the Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology at UW-Madison, both educated at various places on the American map. But Pauly got his bachelor's degree from UW-Stevens Point.
I'm a Pointer, yeah.
You are. Are you from Wisconsin or just go to Point?
Originally from Seattle, Washington, but I grew up most of my life here in Wisconsin. So I consider myself a Wisconsinite, but a Wisconsinite that actually roots for the Seattle Seahawks.
Then you went out west for more of your education, to Wyoming, I saw.
You got it. I grew up in Madison, and then I went to school at the University of Wisconsin, Stevens Point. And then I went out west to Wyoming, where I did my master's. And then further north, where I did my field work for my PhD up in southeast Alaska.
Okay. And Ben, you gathered your degrees out east.
That's right. So I am a newcomer to the Midwest. I was born and raised in Brooklyn, New York. I spent most of my time, and certainly sort of where I learned about ecology, in New England and the Northeast. And then I ventured here about 5 years ago.
Yeah, well, that's good, because if you want snow, this is the place to be.
Exactly. Although central New York,
that's true.
Adirondacks and Catskills and some of those areas get a pretty fair amount of snow, too.
So you guys are colleagues with a lot of the same scientific commitment.
Ben and I arrived essentially at the same time as faculty here.
Okay.
So 2010, 2011. Ben and I, as you noted, have a lot of overlap, at least in the sense of we're interested in winter ecology and how organisms make a living in winter. One of the things that, you know, is a big component of Ben's research program is really looking into climate change effects. You know, regionally, winters are changing rapidly as a consequence of climate change. So that was something that was immediately interesting to me. Ben and I then kind of, you know, came up with this idea, if we can begin to simulate future conditions and really understand what that means for snowpack. Just as you noted, where we are is, you know, part of the snow belt. Seasonal snow is a really important feature of winter around here, but it's one that's changing rapidly. And so we were interested, if we could come up with a way to simulate what future conditions would be like, we could then measure and quantify and predict what that would mean for snow conditions, but not really for the species that Ben and I typically study, which are those that are above the snow. People see, they're visible, they're big, porcupines and fishers or wintering birds. What we became more and more interested in are these smaller critters that live underneath the snow within this subnivium space. The subnivium is something that is so sensitive to changing snow conditions that we realized, first, you know, the majority of biodiversity persists within this seasonal refugium. And secondly, it's one that is really susceptible. And so it was something that we thought would be an important line of inquiry to understand how changing snow conditions then would affect that subnivium space.
Okay, so you guys set up a system to mimic that change. Tell us about those special greenhouses that are dotted around the upper Midwest.
Yeah, that's a great way to put it. We have 27 what we call micro greenhouses, 10 foot by 10 foot up to a steepled roof. They're fully automated. Whenever we have a precipitation event, whether it be rain or snow, the doors automatically open and they collect that precipitation event. After it snows or rains, the door is shut and it maintains an indoor heat above the outdoor ambient. So we can set these greenhouses to mimic what future conditions will be like. For example, we can warm them by 3 degrees Celsius or 5 degrees Celsius. And that way, we can see what those warmer conditions will mean for the snowpack. Our sites then range, you know, as far south as Madison, all the way up to Cloquet, Minnesota, and the Upper Peninsula of Michigan.
So is all that stuff run remotely?
That's exactly right. They're automated in the sense that they record data at really fine timescales. Temperature above, temperature below the snow, temperature outside, and we're also monitoring below snow conditions outside of the greenhouses as well. They essentially have computers attached to the greenhouses that maintain these indoor conditions precisely for us. And simultaneously, they're logging all the data for us as well. So we do these weekly trips to these greenhouses to collect the data.
And I think, too, one of the interesting aspects of this is that these greenhouses are deployed over a very large scale. So we've got them throughout Wisconsin, into Michigan, and Minnesota. And the nice thing or the nice aspect of that is that we capture these changes really over geographic scales in terms of both changes in snow cover and in terms of depth, but also how much snow cover falls throughout the course of the winter season.
Mm-hmm. Climate change. Let's talk about that for a minute. As far as building a foundation, it's obviously a word that we've all been hearing and thinking about. Is there a mile post whereby climate change passed from the theoretical stage to the statistical stage? When did that happen?
That's a really good question. I would say that people really started thinking about this and being able to capture this probably in the 1990s or so, when we really started seeing these changes taking place. Most of what they found, starting back from the late 1970s, was sort of this increase in global temperatures, but it really wasn't until the 1990s that people started seeing this being a real statistical difference in terms of that rate of the change over the last 30 years or so. Definitely when we started looking at other metrics and other sort of responses other than just temperature. So, for example, snow cover is another really good example where we've seen a decline in the amount of snow cover extent really dating back to the 1970s, that over about a 30-year period, it's declined by about 10% or so. It's not just temperature, but these other components as well, precipitation, snow cover, and other aspects of the global climate.
And due to that phenomenon, there is such a thing now, and it's probably a bustling specialty called climate change ecology.
Yeah, that's exactly right, and that's what I'm most interested in. It's not just whether or not the climate is in fact changing, both sort of regionally and globally, but are we actually starting to see species respond to these changes? And that's a big effort on our part, because if we are actually seeing species respond to changes in global and regional climate, then the question is, how do we actually go about managing these species? How do we go about adapting to these changes in the future?
Enjoying a phone call with Jonathan Pauley and Ben Zuckerberg, both assistant professors and PhDs in the Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology at UW-Madison. We are talking about, you may not have heard this word before, the subnivium. You guys are cool. You coined that word.
Yeah, we did indeed come up with that term. It's a term that captures, you know, what we think are the central features of that microclimate, sub, below, nivea, snow, and it's a refugium, that is a seasonal refuge for organisms to be able to persist in winter in this less hostile winter environment.
That's pretty cool. And I think most people, including me, although I'm becoming more aware of it as I study and get to know you guys and your work, a lot of people don't know what's going on under there, and there's a lot of it. Your studies are supported by the National Science Foundation. Was it tough to convince them that this needed study, and when did their support begin?
I think that folks are beginning to realize a lot of the action that happens in the winter occurs underneath the snow. And what I always say is that when we look out in our kitchen window or look out our window in winter, we see this blanket of snow, and it seems to be this great simplifying agent, right? We think of many species that migrate away from winter or hibernate through winter, and we think of winter as a very simple time for these ecosystem processes. But really, action is happening underneath the snow, and it's a dynamic system of species that hold out within that microclimate. Now, part of the reason why there is interest in the subnivium is not just that so many organisms make it through underneath the subnivium. Mm-hmm. It's the sensitivity of the subnivium. It really requires snow characteristics that enable a pocket, an interface to form between the snow and the soil.
It has to be insulating. Yeah.
That's exactly right. It has to be insulating so that it can maintain those temperatures. And those temperatures, once the subnivium forms, mm-hmm. are really stable. And by that, I mean they're at about freezing or maybe just above freezing. And once that subnivium forms, then it holds out. It holds out until the snow melts in the spring. I think that scientists and the public in general are interested in the subnivium because of those two characteristics.
Sure.
It's stable, it's predictable, but it's also under threat.
But the quality of the snow that's there can change, and that affects the insulating factor.
That's right. That's exactly right.
The term blanket of snow, it's not just a metaphor. It's actually a blanket.
It is, absolutely. And I would offer, too, that we are funded under this new idea of macrosystems biology, which is not just sort of that these impacts can happen at sort of a local scale, let's say in your own backyard, But what we're seeing in terms of changes in snow cover are really operating over regional and much larger scales. And so this idea of macro big systems biology also suggests that even though these sort of changes in synovium can occur at a very sort of micro scale, that the implications are widespread and can influence species in terms of their ranges and where they can and cannot be found.
Let's blow some people away. Give us an idea of the scope of organisms that live in the synovium.
Yeah, so organisms that you know utilize that synovium space are typically small to be able to access it. So some of the larger body critters that we can think of are things like weasels or mustelids. For example, martens, American marten, are a state endangered species in Wisconsin, mm-hmm. and they utilize the synovium. They slink underneath the snow, and they use that space to thermoregulate. They have really slim bodies, and therefore they lose a lot of heat. And that synovium offers these cat-sized organisms, these martens, a temperature refuge, but also smaller organisms like voles and mice remain active throughout the winter. So it's also a rich hunting ground for species like martens. Other species, like wood frogs, go through whole-body freezing. Their approach to confronting winter is to allow, through a controlled approach, their body to freeze. By enabling their body to freeze, they really depend on consistent and predictable temperatures, so that if the synovium disappears, it gets too cold, it can outstrip their ability to maintain that whole body freezing, and they can die. If they are coming in and out of that frozen state too frequently, they can exhaust their resources and die.
And it's not just fauna. There's important flora under there.
That's right. Plants can stay photosynthetically active. They can germinate. There are species that really rely on that synovium, not just to get through winter, but to actually thrive through winter.
I found it interesting how similar the words climatic and climactic are. You know,
hilarious. Yeah, Ben and I have talked about this.
The only difference is a C, as in see, I told you so.
Yeah, that's great. I'm going to use that.
Playing the role of doubter advocate, why should we care about mice and voles and fungi and oh my?
Yeah, I think, you know, that's a question that I've heard before is, why should we care about these northern communities? What does it mean for me? And I guess the way I approach that question is kind of twofold. One is that I'm a Wisconsinite. I value my northern communities. I like that we have snowshoe hares and martens and ruffed grouse. Those are species that aesthetically I value. I like having them present on these winter landscapes. But also, it's a question regarding uncertainty. We're seeing species disappear, and we're seeing novel assemblages of species that have never been seen before. And given that, the loss of some species and the arrival of others, we as scientists don't have much predictive ability to understand how these communities and ecosystems will function and what the costs of those changes might be to us.
It sounds as if we're kind of giving up and saying, well, the best we can do is figure out how to help these guys survive in the situation that's coming.
Yeah, and I think that's right to an extent that these changes are coming, and part of what we do is trying to predict or give some sort of assessment of what these changes mean for the species that we all sort of interact with and value. Mm-hmm. But I would say, too, that a lot of what we do is work with people on the ground to think about how we can adapt to these new changes. Are there differences of how we manage our natural resources, how we even recreate, that we may have not thought about before, that can help protect some of these species' sort of very vulnerable habitats?
Also, it's important to realize that climate change is not occurring in a vacuum, and there are important things that can attenuate or accentuate some of these changes we're seeing. Uh-huh. So part of our project is to understand how different forest cover types may influence the loss of the synovium. So there could be management strategies that can help attenuate those consequences mm-hmm. of climate change.
I guess my point is, it just simply too late to stop climate change, and now we have to facilitate living with it? Or are you in a race, or what's going on?
I think that we are in some ways locked in terms of what we are going to see in changes over the next 50 years or so. But mm-hmm. that being said, I think every day that we delay having a meaningful conversation about mitigating the effect of climate change and what we can do as a society only lock us in more in terms of that future trajectory. Most scientists do believe that we haven't crossed any sort of critical tipping point, that what we do now in terms of the actions today can influence both the lives of our children and grandchildren and into the and future generations.
Those of us who care are always listening for ways that we can help, and hopefully we respond. Are there specific things we can do to help the subnivium subsist, or is it simply another thing that will benefit from our attention to the much larger issue?
I guess I would say, you know, maybe both. I'd split the difference and say there are things that we can do. The subnivium is lost because of climate change, but it's also lost because of things like snow compaction. The subnivium can be simply lost by, you know, extensive areas of snow being compacted by things like recreation.
Yeah.
Or the subnivium can be lost at greater rates in places that have different kind of forest types. So there are things we can do, but it also then falls within this broader, you know, envelope of just climate change being a major driver.
I'm going to follow it, and I hope people listening are going to follow your research. Are there ways to do that online?
Visiting our websites, I think, is one stop. In terms of other broader efforts, too, there's WICI, which is the Wisconsin Initiative for Climate Change Impacts.
Our greenhouses are at public sites. I mean, we deployed these at predominantly university-owned sites. You know, there's signage up for them. We ask that they don't touch them, but there's something that they can learn from.
Yeah.
This project is really in, you know, just the first couple years of its lifetime. And so as more and more data come out and more information we have, we'll be distributing that.
You guys are doing good work. It's very enlightening to talk to you. I appreciate you being with us on Spectrum West, Jonathan Pauley and Ben Zuckerberg. Keep it up, men.
Will do. Thank you for the good interview. Those were really great questions.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
That's a lot of fun. Here's a Spectrum memo. The Valley Art Gallery on Bridge Street in Chippewa Falls holding an artist reception Saturday, 1 to 5, welcoming featured artists Lisa Murray and Melissa Todd. They'll discuss their fiber art. Refreshments will also be served. Thanks, Allison, for promotion, Debbie for posting and prodding, and Dean for principaling. That's the action verb for being a principal player, principaling. I'm Al Ross. This is Spectrum West. Hey, don't forget, last week we met her. Ellis takes the stage at the Heidi Center in Chippewa Falls Saturday night, 7:30. That's going to be a great show. Tickets at cvca.net, 726-9000. We'll be here again next week. Hope you will be, too. Bye now.